There are many things that we can learn by merely considering the achievements of our forebears. It is not difficult to make a new and useful application of some known and appreciated principle. But it is not easy to discover a principle. It is not easy to build without recourse to that which has gone before. And therefore we have a peculiar admiration for these basic thinkers of the race, flourishing in different times without the facilities and advantages which we take for granted. We have to ask ourselves, how did they achieve these basic principles upon which all later knowledge has come to be built? There seems to be only one possible answer, and that is that there is a source of knowledge within the self, a power of reason to achieve a scientific exactitude, a power of intuition to apprehend the truth of a matter, even though this truth cannot be immediately subjected to scientific verification. We do not know precisely how the philosophy of atomism came into existence. The first atomist is probably not remembered at all. But from the Greek records, it is believed that the theory was first promulgated, at least in Western culture, in Phoenicia, at possibly a period prior to the Trojan War. This would probably mean, by general checking, that the atomic concept came to Greece as early as the 16th to 18th millennium, 18th century BC. This means that it precedes the golden age of Greek philosophy. It contributed to this philosophy. But Greek philosophy was already dependent upon a much earlier tradition. We can therefore only say that what we call today the philosophy of atomism certainly existed at least 4,000 years ago. Also, we know that its original development was largely religious. It was one of the religious convictions that gradually moved into the area of philosophy. And from philosophy, in turn, was taken over by science in the 17th and 18th centuries of the Christian era. We know, of course, that these first thinkers did not have the full advantage of the long research and thought that man has since devoted to this subject. We are not certain that all of their opinions are true. We suspect, however, that the peculiar integrity which enabled them to establish these basic concepts and hypotheses may also have given them some unusual intuitive grasp of the larger meanings which perhaps we are now ignoring. Certainly, at an early date, atomism became a distinct philosophy, a philosophy of spiritual, intellectual, moral, and also physical significance. With our new developments in the field of atomics, we may therefore contemplate the possibility that here again a philosophical and religious structure may ultimately be built upon a scientific concept. Philosophy and religion made this concept possible. Philosophy and religion must perfect that which has more recently been achieved. In order that we can have some general perspective on this, I have attempted to set some kind of a starting point, to find some mind that in the past gathered up the still earlier fragments and presented them to us in a more consistent, organized pattern. This mind was nearer to the old foundations and therefore may prove especially useful. The first and most important thinker that comes to mind in this relationship is Pythagoras of Samos. And I strongly suspect that he will ultimately be considered, if not the first, the greatest of the Greek atomists. Now, we are not inclined to consider Pythagoras in this light. We think of him more as a mystic, as a great contemplative thinker, strongly religious, and at the same time incorporating in his mentation many basic scientific disciplines and methods. From an earlier source, Pythagoras derived his concept of the atom. Now, our word atom, like our word psychology, has come gradually to mean the exact opposite of its original significance. The root tomos means cut or to divide. Atomos, or atom, therefore means that which cannot be divided. Now, that is an interesting point, because we've made so much of this concept of smashing this minute particle or creating a division within it by what we call fission. The indivisible concept, atom, became significant to other Greek thinkers. And during the period of the Ptolemies in Egypt, atom became a proper term for deity because of the concept that deity is indivisible. Pythagoras, searching for his term, a term which was later to be taken over by von Leibniz, hit upon the concept of the monad. Therefore, to Pythagoras, the monad was the atom. Now, the monad, according to the Pythagorean concept, was an indivisible unit which should not be considered identical with one or any concept of numeration as such. The monad was the seed of number. The monad was number indivisible as absolute and ultimate unity. Therefore, in his thinking, the atom became the sovereign symbol of that which is essentially unchanging, inevitable, indivisible, infinite, and absolute. Pythagoras also pointed out that this term is peculiarly applicable not to great mass, but to an invisible and minute thing, so small that it cannot be seen by the ordinary eyes of man. In these terms also, we realize that our older philosophers were functioning without benefit of any instrument or device by means of which minute forms could be examined. The monad of Pythagoras was a philosophic atom, which he regarded as being the indivisible, ultimate smallness, the least comprehensible or conceivable unit that could exist. Pythagoras also, however, gave us a philosophical point which may have bearing upon our modern thinking, namely that this unit, immeasurably small, became the peculiar symbol and emblem of totality itself. This was the thing minute, but also possessing the ultimate quality of power, unity. Therefore, the atom was not only the smallest of all things, but the most perfect. Being most perfect, it was most like the infinite itself. And the atom, therefore, became the symbol of the continuing seed of existence, a very minute seed from which all things must by their natures grow. Therefore, he termed this monad a seminal principle, a principle seed-like, capable of continually unfolding according to a principle. Now, Pythagoras was already well enough aware of the general principles to conceive that the unfoldment of the atom, or the primary seed, could only be attained because this seed was able to gather to itself other atoms like itself, and that growth was therefore an increasing aggregate of unchanging energy substance units. By this we mean that the atom actually did not merely extend itself. It exercised a kind of influence or force by means of which it attracted and repelled, attracting according to one nature and repelling according to another. The continual attracting of atoms means the increase of mass. The division or breaking down, the repulsion of atoms, means the reduction of mass. The attraction and repulsion of atoms is due to another principle, this principle called energy. Therefore, the increase of energy activates atomic structure. The decrease of energy subtracts from atomic structure. The moment two or more atoms are brought together, a change takes place, for out of this union is produced the foundation or basis of mass. Mass is no longer composed primarily of parts. Intellectually, it is a continually developing unit. Therefore, mass represents a new kind of structure. But this structure is also, by its own nature, monadal or unified. It differs, however, from the basic atom or monad in one particular. This compound is dissolvable, for all things composed of parts that can be dissolved by the dissolution of the parts. when all dissolution takes place to its infinite degree, and nothing remains that is separable, that which does remain is atom, which is no longer susceptible of further division. The Pythagorean concept was taken over by Leucippus, a philosopher following Pythagoras and preceding the period of Plato and Aristotle. Leucippus had one or two further contributions to make. He was the first to point out that the universe itself could be divided into two essential qualities, conditions, or states. One of these he called ends, and the other he called non-ends. Ends is something. Non-ends is not something. That which is not something is nothing. That which is something must forever exist. And when all and every change has taken place in the condition of that which is something, it must be reduced to the basic symbol, something. And this basic symbol of something is atom. This was perhaps his most luminous contribution to our problem. He did not, however, proceed as far as another philosopher who preceded him. And this other philosopher gave us the theory which we now associate with the atomic philosophy of Democritus. This philosophy has to do with the final organization of the entire concept of ends and, non-ends. So we will try to get a pretty fair survey of this, for it is in turn from him that the Platonic and Socratic concepts of atoms gradually integrated to reach the highest condition or state which they attained in the Greek classical world. From that time on, the next most important change was brought about by the Arabian schools, largely vitalized by the early Jewish research in atoms, something we know very little about, generally speaking. But the work was hard progressed in that area. So we come back to the original concept of Leucippus, the existence of ends and non-ends, which now take the simple term atom and vacuum. Now, vacuum, of course, is obviously the non-ends. So existence itself consists of two primary qualities, atom and the absence of atom. Atom, having an existence, has to exist somewhere. This somewhere must also be an environment that is negative to the atom. If the environment was positive, the atom would be overwhelmed. Its natural procedures would be frustrated, limited, or distorted. The only condition in which something can achieve its own consequences without inhibition or limitation of any kind is vacuum. Now, at the present moment, we are not considering vacuum to be a particularly congenial environment. But perhaps we must also bear in mind that our ancient friends conceived these terms with a somewhat different usage from that with which we are familiar. In the thinking of Democritus, atom and vacuum have one quality in common. Both are infinite. atom is infinite in number. A vacuum is infinite in area. Beyond these qualities, nothing can be conceived. The Greeks were not prepared to say that vacuum came from anything, nor were they prepared to say that atom came from anything. They affirmed, somewhat in the psychology of Buddhism, that atom was eternal, and that the term infinite implied not only number and duration, not only number and extent or expanse, but also duration. So we have infinite number, infinite space, and infinite time. Now, time is not a thing in the sense that vacuum is a negative environment or atom a positive factor. Time, therefore, is the measure of the motion of atom in vacuum. Now, we're not speaking in terms of modern physics now. We're speaking in the thinking of the Greeks, somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 centuries ago, as this theory was being well developed about 450 B.C. What now, then, are we to consider to be the source of either vacuum or atom? Our philosopher tells us that there is no source, that these two are co-eternally existing, that there can never be a time, conceivable or inconceivable, when the infinite expanse, which we call vacuum, does not exist. Nor can there ever be a time in which atom, the primary inhabitant of vacuum, does not exist. Atoms do not come, according to the Greeks, from a previous condition of any kind, nor do they lead to a future condition of any kind. Under all circumstances, everywhere, always, they are themselves. This means that they have a peculiar spiritual significance. If there is a God, according to the atomists, this God must partake of the nature of atom, or atom must become the appropriate symbol of the power of that deity. For it is therefore necessary for us to parallel the Greek concept of atom and say that the atom was never created, and come immediately into one of the statutes of our Christian creed, God uncreated. In other words, without a source, a parent, or an origin. Now, in theologies, in systems, and philosophies, these concepts have been assailed. But, for our purposes, we can follow for a little while the Greek thinking to the effect that the atom is an infinite structure, and that it exists in an infinite place suitable for the continual existence of itself. Well, you have now this infinite mass of minute units existing in an infinite area of potential. What now do we have to have in order to have something happen? Obviously, something has to happen, because we cannot simply leave these atoms forever themselves, and this space or this vacuum forever itself, without ending ultimately in a static condition. There is no impetus or factor present by means of which the motion of atoms is impelled. For the Greeks were very particular to point out that the atom itself does not possess the power to move itself. This brings in another dimension. And here's a point which perhaps someday will be useful to modern science. I believe there is some evidence that it is already being considered. The possibility of what we term atomic energy actually existing in the interval between atoms and not resident in the atom itself. This is a point in which more research will have to be carried on. It is possible that this thing we call atomic energy has been misnamed. In any event, the new factor, the new element which has to be introduced, presented a problem to these older people because, in a strange way, they were subtly materialistic. The Greeks produced many schools of materialistic philosophy, so did the Hindus. We cannot assume that all of these systems were pure idealism. They were not. There was in the Greek thinking a continual reaffirmation of scientific method. So they were confronted with what to call this agitating agent, by means of which something forever the same suddenly became different. Aristotle struggled with this, and finally, more or less concluded that this agent by which all things are moved was co-eternal with atom and vacuum. In other words, our duad becomes a triad. And we now have atom, motion, and vacuum. No good philosopher, however, could afford to leave motion just moving. He had to try to understand the significance of motion. So our old atomists came up with a very interesting concept. Namely, they called motion necessity. This is a rather interesting and startling point of view. You remember that Plato describes how the universe moves upon the spindle of necessity. Now, the word necessity simply implies that certain things have necessary and inevitable attributes. Necessity is, therefore, not only the mother of invention, but for our atomists, the mother of motion. Things must move. Now, why must they move? Because it is necessary. This helps a little, but still leaves us on the forms of the principal dilemma. Why is motion necessary at all? We've often asked that question on another level. Why do we have to work? When a certain kind of physical inertia seems to be a most highly desirable state. Under the heading of necessity, the Platonists and several other sects among the Greek philosophers used the idea of an immutable and inevitable law forever operating. Necessity then begins to take the form of law. Motion is necessary because it is lawful. That this compound of ends and non-ends, atom and vacuum, not only has an existence, but has an existence in necessary law. Therefore, certain processes are innate, not necessarily in the atom, not necessarily in the vacuum, but operating upon atom in vacuum. The necessity must be something needed by something. Therefore, necessity is not needed by vacuum, vacuum being nothing. Vacuum needs no modification or change because there is nothing to modify or to change. Therefore, law has a natural affinity for atom rather than for vacuum. For necessity can only accomplish if some means of accomplishment, some substance upon which accomplishment may take place, also has an existence. Here our Greeks began to cater a little to the popular thinking of their time and introduced a spiritual equation. We may say they did it reluctantly, even as modern science does it reluctantly. But there are certain problems that cannot be solved unless we make some kind of sense out of necessity. We cannot conceive of motion without a power called the mover. Things do not move of themselves, according to our atomists, therefore they must be moved. They cannot be moved by vacuum because nothing can move anything. They must be moved, therefore, by something. That something must also, because of the manifested result, be a motion of order. This movement is not a continuing accident. This movement is an intent. That which indicates intent must imply the existence of that which intends. So we have the gradual emergence of an intending power. This intending power cannot be said to be identical with atom. It must, therefore, be another force. The atomists took the attitude, therefore, that there was this intending power which they termed necessity or motion. That this motion moved always according to its own nature. Therefore, there was an inevitable, immutable, unchangeable motion termed oblique. And every atom existing in vacuum was subject to continual agitation by the presence of motion. Motion of itself, therefore, becomes a kind of providence. It also becomes a kind of providence because it provides the solution to the continuing arrangement and rearrangement of atoms. So our next step in our thought or in our problem is to conceive of vacuum as a kind of a vast bottle in which atom is in constant agitation. This agitation being considered primary motion and also inevitable or necessary motion. Necessary not because it was ordained, but because it exists. And that which is so is necessary. This removed certain moral factors from the issue, but did not entirely close it, as we will point out a little later. Motion, moving atoms, resulted in a further condition for which classical philosophers had to invent an explanation. And they did it with extraordinary ingenuity. We are told, even as early as Leucippus, that atoms, though composed of one inevitable substance, differing in no way substantially, essentially, or in quality one from another, had certain difference. One of the reasons why difference has to exist is because that which is the same cannot be differentiated. Consequently, the fact that there can be more than one atom must imply that there is a certain antipathy in atoms. Otherwise, they would immediately coalesce into an indivisible mass and remain that way forever. This does not happen. Consequently, there has to be some kind of difference. And to these early people, there were two kinds of differences which they could accept in their atomic theory. One was difference in magnitude, and the other was difference in form. That which is alike in nature, essentially alike, may therefore differ in size, some being greater than others in mass or quantity. They might also, as Democritus points out, differ in shape, and a new infinity is bestowed upon our problem. Infinite formal differentiation. In other words, all atoms, in some mysterious way, differ from each other. These differences may be so slight that the invisible atom, not even to be seen, cannot be estimated in terms either of similarity or dissimilarity, but it can still exist. Now for the next point that we have to make, we can perhaps use the illustration of a pool table. The pool balls have been racked and have been formed into a triangle. The first player, using the cue ball, strikes the apex or near the apex of the triangle of racked balls, causing this triangle to splinter into many different directions, each of the separate balls moving to a different part of the table before they stop motion. This, according to the Greek theory, would explain how an atom, here represented by the cue ball, coming into violent contact with other atoms, results in this breaking or smashing of an arrangement of atoms. In this case, however, the breaking or smashing is due to an oblique falling motion, in which the particular atom we are using as an example strikes other atoms, separates from them, deflects those smaller or lesser than itself, is deflected by those greater than itself, and before it gets through, makes some of the finest billiard shots that you could possibly imagine. These atoms, moving therefore, are said to move eccentrically because their motion is impaired or conditioned or deflected by themselves in their interrelationship. Those atoms which by some nature are of a similar constitution, exercising a commonly cohesive principle, or, as Democritus said, by their shapes interlocking, begin the building up of mass. Mass results in the existence or manifestation of a new quality, and that is the attractive power of mass. And gradually, mass, by its attractive power, gains momentum and causes more and more atoms to be drawn into the orbit of an increasing mass. The result of this, said our Greeks, is the creation of planets. Now, we are not ready, perhaps, to assume that that early this was contemplated, but actually it was. Now, the Greeks, trying to explain the different kinds of things that come into existence from the same basic aggregate of units, also make use of a principle derived from the Pythagorean pattern. If you take five toothpicks and lay them side by side, you can contemplate this little arrangement in two ways. You can say of these toothpicks, here are five one toothpicks. Five single toothpicks. Or you can simply say, this is five. Now, five is not identical with five ones. It is a new concept. It is a new existence because five ones are separate things. The five is a unity composed of five parts. So the tendency of the mind is forever to conceive number in terms of unity. And wherever we transform the concept of separate units into any type of compound figuration, we create archetypal patterns, which Pythagoras called the numbers. If with this five, which we have thus created, we remove a toothpick, immediately five as a unit or unity ceases to exist. And in its place is generated a new unity called four. Four is not just four ones. If to these five original toothpicks we add another, then the unit five disappears. And in its place is a new archetypal concept, six. Thus, in all things, as the Greeks pointed out, the shape of the number six, when you draw it, is different from the shape of the number five. Perhaps this is the difference between a rose bush and a sequoia tree. It is the difference in the overall unit concept. The Greeks did not affirm that there was any essential difference between the basic elements involved in the constructions of existing things. Existing things not only depended upon one basic substance, but for their differentiation depended very largely upon the differentiating, analyzing power of the human mind. The five ones are always there. But the numeral five is possible only to the creature man. This is a philosophical point. Therefore, man is the only creature interested in the fact that there is any difference between the tree and the horse. The horse is not interested. The tree is not interested. But man, because he possesses certain faculties, becomes keenly aware of apparent difference. And by apparent difference, is impelled to assume essential difference. An impulse which is not, according to the Greeks, fully justified. So now, we have not only the problem of explaining the accumulation of formal structure, but we come right down to something that we can't deny today, although we do not understand it perhaps very much better than the Greek did. Namely, that something, they call it the atom, is the common denominator of everything that has an existence. The only thing which is not included among those things over which the atom exercises this common denominative power is vacuum. Consequently, it makes no difference, as Leucippus himself pointed out, whether you are referring to water or fire or the human body or the emotions of man, or the coloring of flowers, it makes no difference what you refer to. All of these things are composed of invisible, minute units that cause difference not from their substance, but from their arrangement. And consequently, everything that exists is a structure built of single blocks, and these blocks are atoms. Now, it is rather interesting that a thoughtful person 25 centuries ago came to that conclusion and remained true to it, because in those days there was certainly very little to build this upon. One early thinker has suggested that the whole thinking came as the result of allowing a handful of sand to run through your fingers. That perhaps this was the clue. And the gradual recognition that by mixing certain cements with this sand, you could create permanent blocks that could be used for various purposes. So we have the sand. We have a foundation or a space waiting for the block. And we have a cement. And this cement, in this case, is essentially the principle of continuing motion. The Greeks also held that all of these structures were in continuous change, but that this change was so gradual that it was not noticeable, but that in time, every form or structure, even the most permanent things in nature, would be totally altered. Therefore, all things are in a continuous state of increasing atoms or losing atoms. All growth, progress, enlargement, or expansion implies the increase. Where this fails, decrease is inevitable. Democritus tells us that man replenishes the body by inhaling atoms, and that the moment the respiratory process ceases and new atoms are not taken into the system, death is inevitable. That life is therefore the continual replenishment of the atomic units from which the structure of man is composed. Now, we probably don't agree in everything with this, but it was pretty good thinking for its time. And someday, our so-called very good thinking is going to look just as imperfect, because we are a long way from the ultimate solution of even the common problems that we are working with on the level of physics today, particularly in the area of nuclear physics. This brings our Greek to the next situation. We have another factor in all things besides form, growth, diminishment. We have another principle which we call vitality, animation. All things that have forms are in some way also alive. Now, actually, the atom, as such, as visualized by the ancients, was neither alive nor dead. It was simply a minute, indivisible thing. Yet out of the aggregation of these atoms, there comes a structure which in turn begins to manifest peculiarities and characteristics. In some of these structures, as in the bird, we find the magnificence of flight. In others, as the plant, wonderful shapes and forms and patterns with magnificent color. We also find that these forms, composed of atoms, develop the power of propagating themselves. And this became quite a serious matter. For although the Greeks were perfectly willing to recognize the building of the new body as merely a repetition of the process of the integration of atoms, they were still against many very difficult situations upon which to build solutions. So, Democritus tells us of another thing, that what we call mind is also an aggregate of atoms. Emotions are aggregates of atoms. Dreams, which we consider fantasies, are temporary aggregates of atomic patterns within the mind. That any form of any kind which can be conceived or imagined, visualized, or brought into existence upon any level of awareness, subjective or objective, if it has an appearance, if it can be differentiated from nothing, it must be something. And if it is something, it is atoms. The next concept that came to these people was an early realization that no matter how materialistic you might like to be, there is something different between bodies and souls. Now, this was a rather difficult one. Souls and bodies could have one common denominator, atoms. This was not too difficult because atoms being invisible anyway, they might aggregate in one way to form a visible structure, and they might aggregate in another way to form an invisible but equally real structure. So our Greeks tell us that a form, which is an aggregation of atoms, may be either visible or invisible. It does not have to be visible. To say that all forms must be visible is to deny the fact that the atom is a form and that this form is invisible. Therefore, being invisible in itself, that which it produces may likewise be invisible. But what is invisible? Invisible is not something that has no form. Invisible is that which cannot be cognized by the faculty range of the human sensory perceptions. Consequently, we have arbitrarily created a concept. It is visible, it is so. It is invisible, it is not so. Depending entirely for this concept upon the limited range of our own visual faculty. The Greeks had outgrown that thought long before the beginning of the rise of modern thinking. They were perfectly aware that wind is invisible, except that it can be felt. That soul is invisible, but it also can be felt. And this feeling is an experiencing, a discovery through use, a discovery through the fact that we apprehend a power without being able to define the boundaries of the form of that power. The atomist would have gone far enough to say that even a sound spoken could not be heard did it not create an atomic pattern. That we hear because sound has become a form or has gathered atoms. But this type of form or gathering of atoms is not visible, but it can be heard. Therefore, different sensory perceptions may therefore be capable of becoming aware of different atomic compounds. We can't differ too much from this, or from their concept that the odor of a flower was due to atoms thrown off from that flower, which could be measured because they struck against the very subtle substances of the olfactory nerve, producing inevitable reflexes in the brain. So our atoms can form many different types of structures. And one of the structures that they formed was the soul. Now, it's not too difficult to create a soul. It is just another kind of body until you reach a certain point. And then you have to either step into new ground, or else you have to fall back upon this process of regressive evasion. We have to say that the soul is a certain structure possessing certain attributes, or that the soul is a structure receiving attributes, or emanating from a preceding structure. Now the Greeks say to us, we know that physically forms, particularly animal, human, plant, reproduce their kind. Therefore, that they are able to send forth a motion by means of which a new pattern, similar to the original pattern, is gradually built up, the phenomenon of growth being nothing but the rapid increase in the number of atoms.